Okay, I'm David Solomonoff, president of the Internet Society of New York, and today we're going to discuss building tomorrow's broadband. Briefly, there's been a lot of discussion about the topic of net neutrality and the possibility of increased government regulation or even rationing of bandwidth as a scarce resource. And today, this evening, we'd like to look at the other side of the coin, as it were, and talk about how to create more abundance, more access, and build out the infrastructure as somewhat, as in my view, as an alternative approach. And we have three people, one here virtually via Skype, and two people in the flesh, Hunter Newby of Allied Fiber, and Joe Calzone of Ions, and then Louis Houle from Quebec, of Connecting Quebec, and also from the Internet Society of Quebec. So what I'd like to do is pass the microphone around and have everybody kind of introduce themselves a little bit in more detail, as they're comfortable doing, and discuss a little bit their projects, both from a little bit of a nuts and bolts technical standpoint, and also a little bit in terms of the policy issues, because I'm interested in having a discussion here about different kinds of policy issues in terms of private versus funding, public funding and that type of thing as solutions for the broadband gap here in the U.S. and also, of course, in Canada and other underserved areas. So I'll throw this over to you because you're closest.
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for having me back. My name is Hunter Newby. I'm the CEO of Allied Fiber. For those of you that are not aware of Allied Fiber, what Allied Fiber is, I'll give you a brief description. But there's a pretty thorough overview of Allied Fiber already on the New York Internet Society site from the last presentation I came and gave. And it's about an hour long, so it's a full history. It gives a lot of the background, which I won't go into now. So in case you're interested, go ahead and check that out. Allied Fiber is building a new duct and dark fiber system for the United States. Started this about a year ago. We're in our first phase, which is between New York, Chicago, and Ashburn, Virginia, through Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's about 1,200 route miles in phase one. It's a multi-duct system. It's comprised of a long-haul duct and a parallel short-haul duct, primarily. And then we have additional duct for growth and maintenance. In addition to the ducts and the separate fiber cables themselves, we also have carrier-neutral co-location facilities spaced every 60 miles along the route. And essentially what this is, it's a confluence of existing businesses that are understood and tried and true and successful in their own right. Most notably, we are not a carrier. We are in the real estate business. We are landlords. And it's very similar, if not analogous, to my prior business that I was involved in called Telex, which was based here in New York City at 60 Hudson Street, which Joe here at Ion was a tenant, customer of ours, still is, at Telex. And, again, I covered a lot of this in the history of Telex and then leading up to Allied Fiber in this other video that I did with the Internet Society. But without getting too deep into it, the dark fiber cables that we put into the separate ducts are really meant for open access. They're meant for everyone to be able to have access to and use and lease. The short-haul ducts or fiber cable inside are available on a monthly lease basis. The long-haul cable is on an IRU basis, which is 20 years, essentially. And the colo facilities are all modular and scalable, and they're also carrier-neutral, meant for multi-tenant interconnect. And the short-haul duct is essentially available for intercept on an intermediate access basis. We have handholds every 3,000 feet, which is a nice short increment, which makes all the real estate around it sort of in play for three main things. Existing networks interconnect, particularly rural networks. So RLEX and cable companies and whatnot, they're having a hard time finding dark fiber to interconnect their own system together or also just to gain access to a greater, larger infrastructure. Then separate apart from that, wireless backhaul, which is a hot topic for everybody here in the U.S., given the fact that we have such expansive geography to contend with, There is no single company that can afford to systematically solve all these issues. So we provide essentially a main artery in the long-haul system, and then the short-haul system is like an on-ramp, off-ramp analogy to a highway, for example. So that subtending dark fiber rings and or laterals can be built from the short-haul duct out to towers within the vicinity. Typically anywhere from 1 to 5 miles is what we've heard that people are, you know, rationally going to build with a return on their investment. And then lastly, high-performance computing and supercomputing and all sorts of very bandwidth-intensive applications which are being deployed in what now is commonly being called cloud infrastructure, which is a very generic term, and I have an issue with people using terms that they don't properly define, and the word cloud obviously has connotations to the public internet cloud. This is not that, clearly. This is a server-based environment. It's typically deployed on a layer 2 infrastructure. It's very latency sensitive, it's very high-end, it's bandwidth consumptive sensitive, and it requires dark fiber. So there are numerous data center development projects underway along the Allied Fiber Phase 1 route for this purpose. And it's also largely due to the fact that the flexibility of the physical infrastructure in the Allied Fiber route allows for data centers to be moved to where power is, where utility companies, substations exist, where there are 50, 100 plus megawatts of power at the cheapest possible rates. That also happen to coincide with tremendous incentives from the state and local government in terms of tax rebates and other things, green initiatives and whatnot, trying to move demand away from central core areas where they have blackout and brownout issues to where there's power available. So anyway, combining those things with the Allied Fiber system, which basically begins and ends at the subsea landing points in the United States, which are the most important points because they essentially hold the continents of the Earth together. And our mission is to provide ample fiber infrastructure for all that need it between those points and every 3,000 feet along the way, which really encompasses a whole lot of folks that have different needs, as I described. Beginning part of second quarter of 2011 is our expected delivery date for the fiber cables themselves. We're in the process right now of completing very large co-build orders with very large entities, carrier and non-carrier. They're buying fiber in increments of 12, 24, 36, 48, 72. We even have an order for 100 fibers from New York to Ashburn. And then a lot of smaller increments, people that want a single pair system wide, some folks that want ribbons but only in the short haul. And all of that also coincides with the need for co-location space and power, which is changing the size of our colo facilities to accommodate for those demands. So in any case, I'll leave it at that for now as an intro, and we'll get into the questions later, more specifically about the things that you mentioned, David.
Okay.
You want me to pass it to Joe?
Thank you, Hunter. Thank you, David, and everyone for inviting us down. My name is Joe Calzone with a company called ION, based in Albany, New York. In 2004, we were able to grab some seed capital from about 12 rural independent telephone companies in upstate New York. The challenge for these rural independent telephone companies, couple-fold. The various entities that the independent telephone companies needed to be able to scale bandwidth and connect to, effectively, what was between them was the incumbent LEC, Verizon, and we had to observe the Verizon tariff to get out of the backyards of these rural independent telephone companies to gain access to dedicated internet access for the DSL subscribers, HD off-air content for the cable TV revenues associated with the customers in these rural telephone companies, and access to IXCs and alikes. We got started in 2004 with seed capital and put together roughly 2,000 route miles of fiber, connecting 15 rural independent telephone companies and the various carrier hotels. That was 04, rather capital intensive business, as certainly Hunter can attest to. So we went out investment making community in 2008 and hooked up with a company called Atlantic Telenetworks, ATNI is their ticker code, and who made a rather significant investment in us. Couple months thereafter, we applied for a rural broadband middle mile grant through the federal government. And through round one, successfully was able to acquire $39 million. We're looking to do another 1,300 miles connecting rural, tertiary, and fourth tier markets across New York State and connecting it onto the existing ION network so that it can connect places like New York City, the Telex base that Hunter certainly refers to. Was really maybe a stroke of luck, but hopefully some good thought too, that has paid the ultimate in dividends, being able to, from a neutral co-location space, be able to connect to 190 service providers, international, different content providers, different pricing options. So that has been critical to us. And so in a nutshell, ION, a middle mile carrier, connecting rural and tertiary markets back to the larger markets, and like to think of us as Switzerland. We have customers such as small cable TV operators, rural telephone companies that are non-investors, ISPs, IXCs, and the wireless providers. And Louis, I think we're going to go off to you.
Great. Very interesting, guys. I'm going to tell you about a smaller scale project. You know, there's one figure that you have to keep in mind when you're talking about Quebec and compare it to the United States. You have to divide by 40. So when you're granted by the government an amount of money, it's not $10 million, it's divided by 40. So I will tell, let's first say that I'm a general manager of Quebec Connect, which is an initiative that's supported by 20 organizations who have been involved in the internet, all kind of businesses, voluntary businesses, co-op businesses, private sector businesses, and those companies have in common one goal. They wanted to connect Quebec because one of the major problems that we're facing is that it's a very low density population that we have up here, and in many rural areas there is no high speed internet at all. So our project is to get, you know, to search really for trouble and go in small vicinities where it's going to be a problem to implement it. So that's what we're busy doing right now, and we're doing it in places that can be some 400 or 500 miles away from the other. And what we're doing, we started in 2007 the first pilot project in northern Quebec. And we are developing some Wi-Fi services. And I'd say that we call it Wi-Fi, but we are using Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi Lite, all kind of radios, all kind of technologies, and also fiber when available. One of the major problems that really often available. So we have, now we're going through projects in something like 12 municipalities and small places, and we're using a mix of technology to succeed in implementing high-speed internet. What we're doing is that we are transferring knowledge. It's really a knowledge sharing initiative. And we're trying to teach form people in a certain area, certain vicinity, in order to have them learn how to run a network, at least to take care of the customer service and, you know, the basic business that you all know all about. And what we are up to is that we're using a mix of how can I say, any network that's available in where we're working. So we're using some fiber optic services. We're using mainly Wi-Fi, trying to connect with service providers in order to get enough juice to serve a community and teach them how to run a service, how to manage a service. And afterwards, we step in another municipality, and this is how we're working. And we've been connected up to now, 12 municipalities since 2007. And the buzzword here is that we will probably never get rich, because it's always a small amount of customers that we can gather in all and every projects. But the point is that up in Quebec, when we're talking about big cities, there is no problem. But when you're talking about vicinities, rural areas, one person out of two can't use high-speed internet. So we're definitely looking at new services, new technologies in each and every project that we're putting forward, because we have to invent some way to get some broadband for the services. And as I was saying a minute ago, we're using here in Quebec by the end of the last century, 1997 up to 2001, Quebec government major program has been put forward to implement internet broadband for all libraries, public services, health services, and municipalities. And this could be called a public service. And this is what we're working on in each and every project, but we're also using private sector broadband. And what we're trying to do is, when we're implementing, for instance, fiber optics, dark fiber, of course, we want to have deals with the rural authorities in order to make it an open network. We're facing some comprehension problems in those vicinities, because you know, the mayor of the place, he doesn't know a word about what the internet and high speed is. He just wants to have the service, you know. And they're not really comfortable with signing an agreement with companies on technologies that they don't really know how it works and how much it would cost, and not technical capacity for those guys. So we're doing some teaching also, because if we were not doing that, I think that we would be that far today. And now we're in some 5 or 10 regional projects, rather important projects now, and everything's going fine since 2007 with a $25,000 first project growing. And the answer is amazing, because people are just beginning to understand that one way or another, the private sector won't be offering the service in the short term. So this is why we're in business, but we're a nonprofit organization. And what's amazing is that for any project, if we need some services of some kind, we have that, what we call the Maillon group behind the Quebec Connect initiative, and we can have some expertise in any field that we would need. But now, we really have to move to shift to something that would be would allow us to go an awful lot faster in developing high-speed internet for the rest of Quebec. This is what we're. This is the point where we're right now.
Okay, I'm going to just quickly throw in a the first question, if that's okay with you. What additional resources do you think that you need now to make that next step or that next jump?
We definitely need developing fiber at a price that would be affordable for the communities. We definitely need some knowledge sharing on the best technologies that we could put forward in our project. And definitely right to look at how we could implement, for instance, in allied fiber type service in for the whole province of Quebec in the first time, and afterwards, why not for the rest of Canada?
Okay, great. So I'd like to now throw it totally open and to questions from the audience here. Are there any questions?
Come on, Bob. I know you got one.
I'll come up with one.
Oh, good. Okay.
Just, I wasn't clear what the ownership model was. Is the network is owned by the nonprofit entirely, or do the municipals own their own network?
It's owned by the private sector, by the municipalities, and by Quebec Connect for what we've been building so far, which is not as amazing as what you've been doing down there, guys. It's some 20 to 25 kilometers so far, you know. We're talking about small projects. We're talking about small investments so far, for a very simple reason, because in those municipalities, when you have maybe 400 customers, you can't afford throwing $20 million in a project.
I have a comment, actually, to make about this. For Louise's benefit and for everybody, we all share the same issues, whether it's New York State, the United States, Quebec, Canada, any country in the world.
Yeah.
It's like physics.
Yeah.
It's like gravity. It's exactly the same wherever you go. 9.8 meters per second squared, it's the same. It's a hydrogen atom. It's the same. And the physics of what it is that we do, before you begin looking at the financial component, and finance is really where things start to get distorted. Because if you don't have a business model and return on investment, then you start to play games with, is it public money or private money? But let's just take a very logical approach at this first, from a network perspective at the physical layer. I only exist as Allied Fiber to do the long haul and have this multi-duct design to provide physical access points, again, as on-ramp, off-ramp sort of concept, for networks like Joe's network, ION, because Joe's just in New York State.
Yep.
Joe goes to places within New York State that are rural and remote by my standards, which, you know, could be Rochester, which isn't rural and remote, but is not a place I go, or Syracuse, or something like that. And they're all very real places that have real population centers and real businesses and real needs. To be successful for what either of us do, there must be subject matter expertise and local knowledge. Now, local on a national basis for me is, I've got a deal with a major US railroad that cuts across multiple states. It's the only way this is getting done. Because you could never do it if you had to go state by state, muni by muni. It would take forever, it would never happen. You'd never have one homogeneous landlord-tenant agreement for decades, which is the only way to build predictability and sustainability in the business model, because it has to be independent. Joe has to deal with municipalities and local entities, because there's no railroad that goes to all the places that he has to go to. So start to think about what's really important is physical access right of way, whether it's a rail or utility or public, whatever. Same deal with Quebec. What Louis has to deal with is a province with, you know, some sparsely populated areas and the challenges of how to get there, but this dealing with the dirt or the air, as it were, because very logically and rationally, he's going to deal with radio frequency as a way to get to endpoints because of the cost effectiveness, and also in some cases because you just can't get a land deal with an entity to get through their piece of property. On a core transport network like Allied Fiber, you can't do radio frequency. It won't work because there's too much capacity in the core. Has to be fiber. And by the way, with every single instance of every customer we're selling to, it has to be ducted fiber. They will not accept aerial cable for a core transport long haul route that's going to carry multi-hundred terabits. Just not allowed. The fear, whether it's warranted or not, is that if there was an outage, there's no B. There's only an A, because there's that much capacity, it can't be rerouted. So all these things need to be taken into consideration as one thinks about how to deal with their own model and their own network issues as presented to them. If you're dealing with a province in Canada, as Louis said, you have to divide by 40. I think Canada, in terms of geography, is probably close to, if not the same land area mass as the United States. I could be off by a couple million square kilometers. But from a population standpoint, Canada's 10% the population of the United States. So you're not going to get the densities at any level, mobile, rural, ISP, or what have you. But there is a rationale to build a coast-to-coast allied fiber type system in Canada, which actually we've been talking about Canadian Railroad about doing that, which would allow the provinces and folks like Louis to intercept too, and then they could deal with their local issues because someone else is dealing with the broader issue of giving them access to the physical air to the outside world. It's all about economies of scale, guys. What we do is provide economies of scale so that everyone can come to us and buy their incremental piece such that they don't have to build it themselves, because independently they could never come up with the business model to finance it if they had to build all of what we're building just for a pair of fibers. And then as you get down to the local area and you can cordon off and section off those different little issues, you can literally deal with house by house, neighborhood by neighborhood, building by building, solving those problems, which is not something my business could ever do. We'd never get anywhere.
Okay.
I agree with that conclusion because, when I was talking about a few miles about fiber that we have here and there, in one of our recent projects, we came to the conclusion that we would need fiber, and we would like to be in partnership with somebody we deal with because. You can't do everything, the network, the service, local contacts, local promoting, you can't do it all by yourself. We need partnership. As far as I'm concerned, the internet is a need. It's a must.
Basically.
And I think that we really have to be working together in order to have it an open access service. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're now trying to achieve. It's going good. It's going fine.
Okay, Joe, did you want to
show?
There you go.
Just a few comments from our experience, certainly Louis and Hunter's comments as well. From an ION perspective, I think, and really a macro network infrastructure perspective, I think Hunter hits the nail on the head in terms of taking care of things. We need that regional and national backbones that is open from an architecture perspective. As they described, ION is really more of a middle mile and working with whatever the last mile service provider might be and the technology. And in so doing, in New York State, some of the things that Hunter doesn't have to deal with that we do, from a policy perspective, there's things that just bend my mind when we look at things such as internet. It is critically important, broadband infrastructure for us competing in a global economy. And in so doing, with the grant, we are most appreciative to be able to, you know, build out new areas, but own policies such as the state DOT wants us and others to look at occupancy and use agreements for the right to be able to use the public right-of-way on a roadside, on for pole attachments. And I just kind of scratch my head and say, we are bringing services to areas that economically, without the grant, you can't get the numbers to work. And now the state is pushing hard to say, hey, we want some revenues. We're going to create a use, an occupancy tax for all new fiber. So we're vigorously, you know, trying to, you know, get that out of the picture. And although from an ION perspective, you know, we don't do a lot of content to the end, and certainly appreciate Verizon and its Fios product and cable TV offering. I would say, as the rural independent telephone companies, we agree with Verizon from the perspective of how many municipalities and communities are in New York State. And to have to be able to get a franchise agreement with hundreds, if not thousands, of these communities, so what? We can bring infrastructure in so that, you know, the people can benefit from broadband and effectively compete. So those are two things from a policy perspective I find mind-numbing.
Is this not addressed somewhat in the national broadband plan?
If I can add to this, we're discussing an agreement with in the Laurentides, you know, let's say a county, where they've been going to a project and the county zoning some network, okay, and they're offering high-speed internet services. They want to get out of that business as soon as possible because they've been discovering that it's not a business for a county to be in. They have to do that. They don't have an expertise to compete with the private sector or anybody who would be offering such services in their county, and they want us to take over and take care of that network. So I think that we have to keep in mind that even though we have to talk with each and every municipalities that we want to work in, we must be sure of one thing. I don't think that a policy that would make them the owner of any network would be a good policy. The importance here is to be able to use it, though. This is quite different, owning it and using it. So if we're talking about an open network, we need a policy where we can make sure that this could be possible for municipalities, for you know, services, police, fires, health, and all what they have to take care of. So I think that there's some win-win agreements possible, but we definitely need to, you know, there's block by block here, some knowledge that we have in different areas, and we have to work together in order to have the whole house put together and working together. But I don't think that the municipality should be running the house, though.
Okay. I have my question, which I'll...
Yes.
I've heard that pole access is addressed in the National Broadband Plan. Can you take that?
Certainly. In the broadband plan, there is access from the perspective of pole attachments are to be allowed, and where technically feasible, a conduit use made available. And that's generally the power utility, the incumbent local exchange provider, and in some cases in these rural areas, they're actually municipal-owned power and electric companies.
Yes.
So those are available, yes, you are correct. What there isn't, though, is the fact that a broadband strategy that everyone buys into. Yes, there's a piece of paper which is called the National Broadband
Program. Just a set of recommendations.
Exactly. And I think some really important things, although we were fortunate enough to be a recipient of the NTIA BTOP funds, a lot of those things went to from the federal government to the states for the states to be able to weigh in. And I would say from an Allied Fiber perspective, creates a problem where you're not looking at the bigger picture. The Allied Fiber approach, I think, is critically important to say, hey, there's regional networks, there's statewide networks, there's municipal networks, and how are they all put together so that there's route protection, there's scale, and really the ability to connect wherever you ultimately need to go. Coming back to your question, what we have, I believe, at least in New York State, is a revenue problem for the state government. So it's busy looking at ways to say, how can I increase revenues? I'm sorry, this is not the way. Because if I go backwards in time, coming from the rural independent telephone company heritage, if you go back turn of the century, there was the REA, the Rural Electrification Authority. And the premise there was we would use government funds to push utilities such as electricity out to everyone. And everyone was to have electricity and a POTS, plain old telephone service. Okay, electricity, I appreciate. It needs to be there. POTS, I'm sorry. And I am growing up on the independent telephone company side. Voice is nothing more than a bursty data application. It's broadband. What we need is broadband. So a national broadband plan needs to take care of things such as, if there's this fund called USF, where a portion of your cellular bill, a portion of your landline bill gets put into this fund, and the fund is available to TDM, rural telephone companies, to help subsidize that? No, it's broadband. So there should be a USF broadband fund, not a USF TDM voice fund.
We'll pass along that
suggestion. A suggestion that came up at the Broadband Expo was that rather than giving out money for networks to build, although there are some good networks that receive money, there was also a lot of misallocated money. Instead, maybe money could be given to rural customers who don't have service, and then they could spend the money on the best available network, and that might avoid a lot of bureaucratic issues and problems. I wonder what you guys think of that.
It's kind of like school choice, right?
Yes. Well, definitely. We've been working on a project last year, and this is exactly what we wanted to achieve. And the goal that we had, we asked for Industry Canada was $275 million or $225 million envelope for rural broadband, and what they've been coming up with is subsidizing companies that are already in the business, and I'm not sure that Bell Canada, for instance, would need such a grant. You know, if they've been in that business for since the beginning, and I'm not against Bell Canada. Good if they do a good job. It's not that the point. The point is that we would have need that money at the rural level, and we didn't have it. Even though We had some applause from the government saying that our project was a great, genius, original and everything, but we didn't get the money. So there's no project in the area where, you know, a year and a half later, there's nothing there that has been done by the major incumbents. And but they're still promising to do something. Maybe dark fiber, maybe, but it sounds to me like all what they're interested in is selling cell phones and putting towers here and there, and towers that, as far as I'm concerned, well, it's a concern for me because there's some health issues that haven't been solved, you know. Well, you know those problems, you're in the business. And well, anyway, we're very concerned about, you know, trying to find some technology and some building some services that would take into consideration green issues and health issues also. So this is what we're trying to do with the grants that we have here and there, but we're confident that where we're going that project, we're confident that the municipalities will understand basically what we're talking about tonight, and they will try to help their helpers and help their citizens to get high speed internet and invest some money, because they will understand that if you don't have high speed internet in the village, I'm sorry, but the kids won't go back there.
Right.
And this is what we hear, the stories that we hear. You know, people don't want to go back in where they're born because there's no internet. So today, everybody's living, you know, when you're living in Quebec City, for instance, and you're using such services, everywhere you go, you want to use internet. And if you don't have it, well, then it's not really interesting to get back in those villages where you're born, where your kids are gonna tell you that they want to get back home because they want to use their iPod and iPad and this and iPad. So you know, this is a day-to-day story that we hear. So it's kind of amazing that. And when you go there, it's amazing to see how you can live without high-speed internet. So I'm not used to it anymore. I don't know if you have such stories down in the States. I know that it might be different.
It's exactly the same. As a matter of fact, from a historical reference perspective, just two quick notes. And then some deep history on the same thing that we're going through right now already happened 150 years ago. 151 Front Street West in Toronto is the main carrier hotel for the eastern portion of Canada. And it's also the first telegraph station in Canada. And it was the first transatlantic telegraph cable endpoint. For Toronto. And there's a tremendous amount of history there. There's actually a plaque in the building that commemorates this. And the point is that things are where they are because that's where they were. And you can go back a century plus, and you can see that entire cities were born on that seed of communications that was planted and grew. Yeah. And the cities that did not have it aren't cities. They never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the same exact analogy is with the railroads, where they put the train station and the depot, then the saloon sprung up and the hardware store and this and that and the other thing. And where the train didn't stop, there was nothing. And same thing with highways. If there's no on-ramp, off-ramp, then there's no town, there's no commerce, there's no people. When you think of any type of infrastructure at all, when you think of the ocean and where ports are where the highways go. And where the rail goes, and where the communication systems go. And everything has sort of a central nervous system and a heart, and communications networks are no different. Western Union, here at 60 Hudson Street, it's the exact same thing. 60 Hudson Street was the world headquarters for Western Union. It was actually their second building. The first building burned to the ground. It was made of wood, and it was painted with polyurethane, I think. and it went up like in 2 seconds. So they built 60 Hudson Street out of brick so that it wouldn't burn down. And they built it out of brick because when the original Western Union building burned to the ground, it took out telegraph communications in the U.S. for months. Okay, we couldn't live with that today. Here's the story, and this is how this whole thing's going to play out. The telegraph, okay, which was a technology, was actually invented by a French guy who took it to England and got it funded because the King of France wouldn't fund him. There you go, it's all about finance again. Because the King of France had just finished funding a semaphore network from Paris to Marseille, and he didn't want to waste the money he spent on that with this new technology called the telegraph. So this guy takes it to England, gets it funded, and then years later the British Navy uses the telegraph flagging from the ship to shore and telegraph to from the spotters on the cliffs of Dover to alert the British fleet where the French fleet was in the channel before they could visually make sight. And it changed naval warfare. And the British Navy decimated the French Navy using a technology that was actually created in France. So ignore technology at your peril. The parallel today is that when the telegraph technology reached the shores of the U.S., it spread like wildfire west. And there were thousands of little mom-and-pop telegraph operators. And they all went raised money to build out local telegraph networks on the promise of the fact that everyone wanted to send telegrams and exchange these messages. Which, by the way, that was the first actual implementation of email, if you think about it. What happened was those mom-and-pop operations basically got it done however they could. And I'm not saying that Quebec or New York or anything's mom and pop, but internet protocol at layer 3 is identical to what the telegraph technology was with zeros and ones and electromagnetic pulses of its day. And what ultimately happened was those independents figured out how to run the high gauge copper wire in trees and on poles and did whatever they could do, and they had certain little regions, but they just couldn't generate enough revenue to pay down their debt. So then came along a company called Western Union. Actually, Western Union's name implies what its intended purpose was. It's a shell company that was funded to roll up distressed telegraph assets west of the Hudson River and unionize them. Okay, it was a roll-up play. And they did this in the 1850s. And they rolled up telegraph networks. Mississippi Valley Telegraph was the first one they bought. Then they bought Washington State Telegraph. They bought New Orleans Telegraph. And they integrated all these telegraph networks into one behemoth powerhouse known as Western Union, which all those high-gauge copper wires tied in together right here in good old New York City, because this was the capital of the world for communications and finance and commerce and everything else. Arguably still is today. It is where it is because that's where it was. So what do we have? A bunch of independents deploying IP, fighting local battles, local knowledge wins the day, the municipal town boards, it's somebody's sister, brother, cousin, mother, father, friend, get it approved. They're doing all the hard work in Quebec and in New York State and everywhere else to get this built out. And at some point, there will be a company funded to roll up all of these disparate assets and make them work as one homogenous system, because that's the normal, natural course of how these things evolve. It is no different than failed railroads and failed utility companies and failed telecom companies. They will get rolled up if their networks are built properly, because the time and effort put into getting homes wired can never be duplicated. And once it's done, other than POTS, which I totally agree with you, Joe, that was a different time in the country. That was a different time. Bell had a monopoly. It was backed by the federal government. The federal government allowed the Bell to charge a tax to the people that was greater than what was legally allowed, which was the subsidy that guaranteed the 8% rate of return, which covered their capex so that they could float the bonds to get the money to build the infrastructure, or else there would be no way to logically finance it. That's fact. That happened. There is no concerted effort in the United States to do a broadband system of the same kind, because what was done by the Bell system was quasi-socialism, but it gave the United States the infrastructure to be the leader in the world for a century. We are now challenged with this, because everything has to be funded on a capitalistic ROI basis in an environment where credit is non-existent. Banks don't lend. They keep taking from the Fed, but they don't lend because they don't trust anyone's credit. Meanwhile, they're the ones that aren't credit worthy, which is bizarro. I mean, if you look at the country's not credit worthy, just keeps printing money. We need to invest those printed paper fiat dollars in real hard network assets quickly before the value of the dollar completely disappears. Because if we don't build that communications infrastructure, we will be third world, because other countries are, right now, nationally backed fiber plans, not broadband. Broadband is a very bad word, it's ill-defined. Other countries in the world have national fiber plans, and they're being backed by the government, and they're building it, and those countries will have their networks complete in 3 to 5 years. Granted, from a geographic perspective, most of those countries, the vast majority, are much smaller than the United States. But if you look at Western Europe or you look at parts of Asia, they're implementing this infrastructure, and then they are interconnecting between nations on the same layer 3 IP basis, layer 2 Ethernet, DWDM, it interoperates. But they're saying to each other, listen, you take care of your own, I'll take care of my own. We'll all meet at the carrier hotels in Amsterdam, yep, and Paris, and Frankfurt, and London, and it'll work. A little different.
I'd like to hear you. I'd like to have your point of view. The show is a policy of investing, what is it, $15 billion in buying the whole internet network. Have you been, what's your comment on that?
Sorry?
I can repeat, Lewis.
Have you been reading a little bit about that project?
I couldn't hear the question.
Have him repeat the question.
Could you repeat the question?
I said, in line with what you just said, what's your point, you guys? Australia's approach?
Oh, Australia's approach.
Australia.
Yeah, it's great. Louise?
You hear me?
I heard you. The NBN, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
It's great. It's the right way to go. I mean, they pulled back the RFP from Telstra because they didn't trust them. Telstra hit the roof, as they should, because they have shareholders. And they have a way of life that they've become accustomed to. But this is about carrier neutral. It's about treating fiber and colo as real estate. It's about operating as a neutral entity, a landlord that gives, you know, unencumbered access, open access, non-discriminatory access, real estate, space, power, fiber. Matter of fact, just recently I read, earlier this week, that the 7 major operators in Italy all got together and agreed to create a consortium to fund it equally. So it's Fastweb, Tiscali, Telecom Italia, and the others, to build a nationwide physical infrastructure, and that they would all share in the fiber and the ducts and everything else. So it's great. And then you know what happened? One of them raised their hand and goes, well, who's going to run it? Who's going to actually open the door and let people in and do the crosscuts? And immediately, they all pulled back. They go, whoa, wait a second. That's a really good point. And none of them trust each other to do that. And what's missing there, in my mind, is Allied Fiber. Now, it could be whatever. It could be called Allied Italy. I don't care. But it's a neutral party that runs the facility, and it doesn't take preference from one or the other. Everyone's a tenant, the smallest to the largest. As long as you pay your rent on time, you get. You pay, you get. But there aren't privileges or benefits of one or the other given the size. So I think the NBN makes a lot of sense, and you know, I'm happy that they were able to survive the election and that the party that's in there kept it in place, because I was a little concerned that the Telstra-backed party would get in and kill the whole thing. And you know, that just shows you really what the what's motivating all this, the background. It's all about money and control and physical air access.
Can we just have some questions?
If I may add, incumbents appear, what we're facing is that when we were in some of our projects, when we were near to beginning something, some high-speed internet project would pop up, and they would, incumbents, sometimes it's hard to work with.
Lewis, we have a room full of people wanting to ask questions, and here we have Bruce Kushnick, I think, is going to talk about.
And Joseph, of course.
No, I'm going to talk about the incumbents, I think.
Actually not. My question is actually for you, Joe.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit more about who your customers are as a middle mile provider?
Yep.
And since the since I can't go without speaking of the incumbents, since the incumbents have decimated competition, I've only heard you complain about getting the supply out there.
Yep.
But I haven't heard you say if you there's a shortage of customers because there's nobody has been providing the last mile. So are there really providers out there? Are there in some of these rural telcos, yep. are they prepared to roll out DSLAMs and have the financing and whatnot to do all that?
Well, basically what we see, what we need is that incumbents don't go in some rural areas because they won't be able to make enough money out of it, out of any investment. They are not very much interested in turning around to see if governments would provide some money for them, because one way or another, they won't have much income that would come from those small areas. That's all. As simple as that. It's not in their business plan.
I'm sorry, Louise.
But,
on the ION side of things, as it stands today, 90% of our revenues are with last mile service providers. So what we have, there's roughly 25 independent telephone companies through New York State, and some of them fairly large, Frontier Communications. But if you look at their geography, Keysville, New York, there might be 1,200 people. This island operating territory, literally in the middle of no place, we spliced our fiber and did a mid-span meet to them, and was able to cut their operating costs for dedicated internet access in half. So yes, you know, there is willingness to do some DSLAMs. You know, the challenge is that you have to be market
competitive. So they've been doing it, they were just, their costs were just, you're able to lower their costs.
We're able to lower their costs, and thus they're able to put in additional DSLAMs into additional central offices, and it just so happens in that same area, we did a fiber interconnection with the local cable TV provider. So when I make the comment, Switzerland, we're, you know, technology agnostic in the sense that whether you need us to transport HD off-air signals from a big city like Albany to a rural you know, area, or hey, you just need a big pipe, a 10 GE from this rural operating territory where there's DSLAMs or cable TV modems down to New York City. So we're just kind of providing that middle mile, if you will, cell towers back to the mobile switching office. So right now, 95% of our revenue is carrier sales, wholesale to last mile service providers.
Is it sufficient, I guess, is
it? It's sustainable, absolutely. What is so encouraging to us is the money that we're spending to do the tower. To have fiber to the towers through the rural independent telephone companies, and fiber to the mobile switching offices, you know, of Verizon Wireless, of AT&T, of T-Mobile, and Sprint Nextel. As I said before, we're kind of technologically agnostic. So 4G, handset, internet access, Skype on my 4G handset, it's a beautiful thing.
It's just transport.
So I don't care, right? And you know, at the end of the day, I'm not betting on any technology. I just want to be able to provide and open up these communities that are rural, tertiary, fourth tier, and connect them to wherever the point of intelligence is for Verizon Wireless to switch, or the cable TV head end, or Allied Fibers Network, Telex. I mean, so our real focus has been wholesale. With the broadband grant that we received, we agreed to be the carrier of last resort. And what I mean by that is there's 125 anchor institutions on this 1,300 miles of fiber that we're going to build. And all of the universities, hospitals on the thruway, Route 87, Route 90, covered like there's no tomorrow. They're in good shape. SUNY, Albany, you know, Buffalo, you know, no problem. SUNY is a 64 campus environment. And there, I hate to say it, but there's huge differences, has and have nots. SUNY, Cortland. SUNY, Mooresville, we went to visit. Colgate University. We went to visit Hamilton. We went to visit St. Bonaventure. And I'll blow your mind. Here's a college institution with 4,000 students, and they were paying over $90 a meg for 200 meg worth of service. So at the end of the day, hey, we're going to go open up those areas, and if Cogent, if Paytech, if Verizon Wireless, whoever wants that, here's a very inexpensive middle mile. Bring competition. Open up competition. And once there's competition in those communities, then I think you have choice. You have choice in terms of a price. You have choice in terms of applications. Choice is good.
No, I'm with you on the go. I just was curious
what we're working on.
Yep.
You know, competition. This is what we're up to. And, there's two things that I could mention about that. First of all, people need to trust you.
Yep.
When you're working with public services, hospitals, schools, municipalities, it takes some time, takes some money. And I would say that in 2000, we're now doing much better than we were doing in 2006 when we just started, you know, concerning trust. This is one point, and I'm quite sure that if you don't have that, you won't succeed, of course. The second point is that we have to work with an incumbent model where they are promised by, you know, their business plan is to offer a 3-in-1, so telephone, TV, and internet high-speed services. But people would like to receive everything, mm-hmm. all at the same time. The network's not really ready for that, and you can't afford putting all that energy that those services it wakes up our available rural areas. So by the time you invest in a network where you can offer all that, well, in the meantime, we're trying to put in place some high-speed internet services, period. We don't even offer TV, nor IP, internet IP, not for now, because we don't have the availability that we need to offer the service. So when we're talking about competition, first of all, of course, we're talking about broadband. We definitely need some broadband up here, definitely. And we don't have it in those rural areas. It's not there. You have to get some money, some funding to do that. And we don't want to be doing that. We don't want to do that at Connect Quebec, because it's not our business. I would like to offer services, high-speed services, but not, you know, the broadband. So everything has to be done. It's not improving.
We've got some comments about incumbency. I think from Bruce Kushnick now.
First, I'm glad you guys are out there trying to beat the bushes and bring the broadband to the other places. That's great. But a couple of things about the history of broadband and where we are. Right now, in the state of New York has been raised rates 90% on local service to pay for fiber optic services, which they are giving directly to Verizon. It is illegal for them to give Verizon the money because they're charging, they're using the money for Fios, which is an interstate information service and a cable service. In the state of New Jersey, today, they've collected $3,200 per household for a fiber optic wire to the home at 45 megabits of which on state law today, 100% of the state is what finished by the year 2010. It's on the books. In the state of New York, they are showing their state, and in New Jersey, they are showing that they lost money for New York Tel and New Jersey Bell. They are manipulating the data because their affiliates are not paying any of the money back to the local incumbents. You talk about the utility model. The utility model is alive and well. It's just that the incumbents basically are taking the money out of the rate base and moving it illegally into the affiliate transactions, where they then give the money to Fios, where Fios then builds the networks and then keeps the networks closed. The fact that this has happened in all of the United States, throughout the United States, in state law,
and
in Canada, they've collected $320 billion today. It's $3,000 a household. It is currently built into local rates today. Now, the question I've always had, and so you bring up the issue of adding universal broadband to universal service. We're already paying for it three times. We're paying for it in the universal tax currently today, which is going to the incumbent and the high-cost fund. We're paying for it in the states where basically the cable companies were supposed to give schools a full broadband access. The schools, the cable companies have collected $46 billion under something called the social contract, which is $5 a month per customer to basically upgrade the schools, the libraries, and their networks. Those networks were never, as far as we know, they were never built. The phone companies are collecting approximately somewhere between $50 and $100 per customer per year, per line, to go out and pay for broadband today. The Universal Service Fund basically has turned into a slush fund, which we've written about, where all the high-cost funds basically are given to companies where they do not look at the total revenues over the line. They only look at the line item that's called basic service. So the broadband company, the broadband part, the phone, the internet part, the cable part are not paying back to the incumbents. Now, the documentation on this is very clear, because if you look at the affiliate transactions in their annual reports, you will see that they, for example, in New Jersey, they had a $315 million expense for internet with no revenue. In the state of New York, they are showing that there is a $1 made in the state of New York, and same thing in Massachusetts. In the state of New Jersey, they showed a $194 million loss, even though their annual report shows that Verizon is doing very well in all of these states. So what's going on is the manipulation of the data and the destruction of the utility system via the affiliate transactions, via them claiming that, now I have to, to put this in perspective, okay? We all talk about investment. Customers are already investing today. That money is already being collected.
Yep.
That money is already in the form of, if you go back to the New Jersey law, you will see that they have raised, $3,200 per household, and it continues today. So the question I have is, why isn't anybody going out trying to get the money back at the municipality level? We dealt with municipalities in New Jersey. The problem is that Verizon walks in and says, the lobbyist for Verizon is on the board of this municipality. The mayor had to recuse himself in one city because, he works for Verizon. The incumbent lobbyist calls Verizon and calls the municipality and says, excuse me, but as far as we know, we not only are not going to pay you property taxes anymore because we believe that we're now competitive, which is what's going on in New Jersey. New Jersey has lost $150 million of property taxes in the last 10 years because Verizon claims it's competitive. So the question I have is, while we talk about all the broadband plan, we filed with the FCC, I think it was 16 times, mm-hmm. pertaining to the economic structure of customers as the funding source for broadband today.
Yep.
So my take on this is that if you want to go out and if you bring up the issue of investment, we're already making an investment. The question is how do we get the money that's supposed to be directed to the networks back into paying for the networks, back into making the utility functional? And I believe that should happen. My take on it is it's not going to happen because the National Broadband Plan, the head economic advisor happened to work for one of the think tanks that was paid for by Verizon and by AT&T and by Comcast. So what you have basically is a situation where it really isn't about the networks. It really is about the political system on top of the networks.
Sure.
And so my question is how do we get the money back and use it for what you want instead of raising the Universal Service Fund?
Sure.
Because someone wants to make a comment right at the back.
Yeah, it's actually more of a follow-up question, so if you guys want to comment on his question, go ahead.
I'll make one quick note, and then we'll move on. I said I would make one comment on what Bruce just said, and then we can move on. This is Hunter speaking. I've thought about this a lot, because you're right, and it's wrong. It's the same thing that Bell did 100 years ago.
Now we know that.
Yeah, here's the deal. And I'm not coming out on this one way or the other. I'm just saying this is what I think reality is. There's collusion going on. It's politics, it's money, but it's collusion. It's a question of how does the United States make it look like it's capitalism and make it look like it's a business that's generating profits and all sorts of stuff? And the comment was made by Louis and the incumbents up in Quebec. They don't build to rural areas because they can't get an ROI on it, which is why Verizon dumped their RLX up at Frontier, which then you know properly tanked like 30 days later, because you can't figure out how to make a business out of that. The future's fiber to the home, and then you drop a femtocell on it, and you get free wireless backhaul. That's beautiful too, right? You know, for them. But they weren't about to spend money on it if they had to share fiber. Now, remember 03, the triennial review and the hoodwink everybody got, where they were like, we want broadband relief, so we'll let the CLECs keep uni, but give us broadband relief. So the FCC went, oh, okay, and all the CLECs who had no choice, because they said, well, if you take uni away from us, we're dead, so give them broadband relief, give them total monopoly protection on fiber. And they gave it to them. And then 3 months later, they took uni away anyway. Remember that? Okay. Yes. Wasn't that great?
We all remember that.
Yeah, how come?
Them into long distance, and then they
how come nobody talks about that? Well, because it's all part of the same thing, Bruce. It's all planned out. None of this is like on a whim. It was all thought of a long time ago. And this is a strategy that's being executed upon. It's a very well thought out strategy, and everything that you see is an illusion in front of you, because the real plan, which is not made known to anyone, is that in order for the fiber to the home infrastructure to be built at a cost of $5,000 per sub, which cable companies are only getting a public market comp, last time I checked, around $1,500. So why the hell would anybody spend 5Gs? Is because 32 of it's getting subsidized, and then they're using it for free wireless backhaul where they don't have to pay a tower owner for an antenna attachment, and they don't have to pay somebody like Joe for transport from the tower back, because you know Mr. Smith at home there is paying for his IP connection. Probably to Verizon or somebody else. So it's like a triple win for them. But the bottom line is that the United States of America is challenged because of its geography. Mm-hmm. We're too gigantic of a country for one single company to be able to afford to finance the entire infrastructure to the home and the core and everything else. So it's got to be broken up into different parts, and
but that's why
it has
state,
to be financed
that's why
this
the state
way.
Had its own agreements. Every state, which is the size of a country, you could say in some cases,
certainly.
has a separate agreement within that state, which was basically created because the phone company was the local service, and broadband was an interstate service.
Listen, there's a difference between IP being ubiquitous, and then there being a homogenous physical infrastructure, which if you let the states build their own.
No, not the state. The phone company said to the states, we'll build it. You just give us the money.
Well,
and they did that, and then they
could
build it.
It could, yes. And it could be, all right, that could be even a different way of, maybe that's a different facet or different dimension. Right. My point is that for any large, you know, RBOC or whatever you want to call them today, whatever they even are anymore, they're crossing state lines and they're building out regions of the country, and they're doing something for the country in that sense to help keep us, again, with our 300 million square kilometers, keep us viable or competitive in the world. Not that we are, because it's unfair to put the United States against the Netherlands or South Korea or Luxembourg as a country, because they're also small, relatively speaking. It's about how do you finance the infrastructure build, and a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes to all of us would be, you know, it's just like, oh my God, I can't believe it's an outcry. This is illegal. This is that. If they didn't get their way like that, they wouldn't be doing it. And if they weren't doing it, no one would be doing it, because if it was left to everyone else, mom and pop, to do it, I don't even know who would do it. Who would be doing all of these little things? It's too gigantic. And then there would be all these little mom and pops like the telegraph stations. They would all fail.
Through structural separation, a company, which would be called whatever you want to call it, would be
the NBN,
which would be controlling.
Well, on the core. Wait a second. On the core. On the core. I understand this. At the core, connecting the subsea and providing access points along the way, I can do that. And we're doing that, and that makes sense. But going to the homes, man, there's a whole lot of jungle out there. And you need, like, Sherpas out the wazoo with weapons pointing every way. I get in a railroad right away. I duck my head. We go. People come meet us.
We don't walk right away. We need you guys.
Yeah, I know.
You're on the cutting edge of basically the confrontation that needs to happen.
Just remember where they're coming from. That's all I'm saying. But, not saying it isn't illegal or bad, or we can go chase them and go to town hall. And the guys are on the board, and they're all getting paid off. Yeah. It's the way it works in every country in the world, by the way. They're doing this to build fiber to the home, to deliver fiber speed, which we're all paying huge rates for. But without that, nobody's going to have any broadband speeds to anything anywhere in this country at all.
Right, but
it's too fragmented.
If you talk about the municipalities building it out, each one a little separately, my take on this is the state, which is a reasonable size to deal with, has already been dealt with. It is a utility. It is a functional equivalent of what we're talking about. And the thing that's interesting is nobody's actually said one. Back in, I don't know if you know this, 1999, 2000, AT&T went state by state, so let's have structural separation. Yeah. We can't compete because we can't get control of the networks. Right. So my take on this is if we don't talk about structural separation and separating the companies from the wires, and then having the wires built out as paid for currently, you have to understand there's plenty of money to build out the networks. You talk about rural areas.
Yeah, well,
the monies are divided, the expenses are divided up through all of the customers, and therefore the expenses are divided through all the customers.
ION is an NBN for New York State. Right. That's it. Let the states have their own ions.
I don't say that we shouldn't give the money to third parties to build.
No, but you know what's happening? Look, if we're going to deal with the old world in the way that it was, and all that slush fund money and everything else, and it is what it is, Joe's still here. ION's here. Even with all that, ION's
here. Let's give him the money.
And I'd love to give him the money, but he's still getting it done. So I raise my hand and say, you know what? Let's every state in the country have its own ION, and let's have all the ions figure out how to connect to the national ring, and let's just do it.
Right.
Stop trying to figure out how to stop them.
It doesn't get the wire to the home.
It doesn't get the last mile.
Well,
I'm not doing the last mile.
That's a different argument.
Wait, let me give you the worst example. AT&T is in 22 states.
Yeah.
It has taken over half of the United States. AT&T is currently rolling out U-First. U-First is based on the copper network going back to the house. Its top speed is, 25 megs at this point in time?
Exactly. And 17 reserves.
Right. In 19 of the 22 states, they had laws on the books to rewire the entire state with fiber. And they are already collecting the money for those states. Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, California, Texas. Those are all states that should have been rewired. Now, the money's still being collected today. Mm-hmm. It's basically a functional equivalent of a broadband tax. Mm-hmm. My answer to this is let's separate the phone companies and get that money to do the upgrade. Okay, now you're going to say,
yeah. We have some questions in the back. If we could just throw them over to Lawrence and
don't pull.
Should I pull down your laptop now?
I'm going to look
at the table.
Can you step forward a little bit?
Coming from Sweden, this is a pretty amusing discussion where we sort of solved this by us building a big network with government money and then getting that money back by sort
you of run healthcare too.
Open access. Yes, we do. And it's great.
And you have blondes. You guys can talk about it.
So, I'm on Facebook. So my solution to this will of course be ended having the states actually build a network and just renting out capacity in that, as we do in a lot of other places in the world. Now that's
Wait, how long have you been here?
On American way of doing it. But I mean, my second question is a bit how this ties back into the net neutrality theme that was like the topic of this evening.
Oh, net neutrality? Yeah, that's the this gigantic misnomer. That's scary.
I'll just say that when I was talking to Colette in the council to the National Broadband Plan last Monday, and he laid out all these plans for taking USF money and E-rate, and I said to him, but don't you have to go to Congress to make these changes? And he said, no, we
can do
the FCC can do what the hell we like, which kind of surprised me. And Bruce's plan, I know, is to like sue the arse off these phone companies if we can get the money to fund his court case, starting with New Jersey, because they're due in 2011 to have everybody, January 2011, to have 45 megabits to every single household in New Jersey. And if they don't, then they're in breach of some breach of contract with the public trust. And this is combined with Alex's idea of like user choice. So if we can like sue the money back, the $320 billion back, and the users can then choose to like give it to Ion, then we'd have a solution to the
problem. I like the. I'm not sure. It's in Scandinavia. I'm not sure if it's Sweden or Finland, but the do-it-yourself, bring-your-own-fiber deal, where like the farmers are building their own fiber networks.
First mile solution.
Yeah, right on. First mile, do-it-yourself.
Bring it on.
Yeah, bring it. Get your own interconnect points and splice. in Finland, broadband is now a birthright. It's been legislated, I guess, in their government that when you're born and you're born in Finland, you're a Finnish citizen, you're entitled to, I think it's a megabit.
they had one national network.
It's a megabit per year.
Yes.
So
when
you're 19,
but the point is that it may be like whatever the fraction is, they take it very seriously, they take it nationally, and they don't look at it as we do. Again, it's a geography thing, it's a politics thing, it's a population thing, it's a money thing. They realize that this is good. They need it because it's life. It's like water or electricity. It's how they're going to be educated, stay healthy, and it's what's going to drive their economy. And we all see that here. But there's just too much politics involved because there's too much money involved and everybody's got their hand out. Whereas a lot of these other countries just say, you know what, it's not that big of a deal for us to all squabble over. Let's just get it done and move on. Because as you said, the wrong way to look at this is for the states to say, oh, we're going to tax the access. We're going to tax this and that. You're looking at the wrong thing. Yeah. You should let this thing grow and then all the things that come from it, which are going to drive tenants. The way I look at everything is real estate now. So if you had a really good broadband system, businesses would move there. And people would move to work there and live there. You'd have towns, and then you'd have sales use tax, property tax, and everything else. Instead of trying to kill the goose that lays the golden egg up front, which is what a lot of these folks are doing. Whereas in Scandinavia and other countries have a different way of looking at it. They just said, well, let's just build a network and make it work great and do duck deals and do right-of-way deals and do fiber deals so that everybody can come and get infrastructure on a very cost-effective basis. So there could be multiple networks and lots of competition, so we get the best of breed, quality of service, best price for the consumer, and we've got amazing networks and applications, and we'll be ahead of the world, and at least competitive with the people that are leading. That's the right way to look at it, and unfortunately, we don't have that situation right now in this country.
Okay, Louis?
Talking about Scandinavia, isn't it a source of innovation, is it?
Well, at least it was. I don't know. We got lazy over the past couple of years.
I'll say something about this, that Barbara Van Schrick spoke at my law school last week, and her about net neutrality, which is her thing, and her theme is that discrimination, blocking, and this kind of thing could be a good idea if it's at the choice of the user rather than the provider. So if you want your Netflix to come in and to throttle down that you can do this. And but I talked to her afterwards and I said, well, we've got a lot of guys at ISOC NY who believe that, infrastructure is the answer, and that if we have more infrastructure and more competition, that's going to solve net neutrality and everything. And she said, well, funnily enough, from my research, in Europe, where they have unbundling and all this, they're all throttling and discriminating like hell because the economic pressure of being in competition means they've got to get the biggest bang for every bit going, so there actually is more. There's more kind of like anti-neutrality action going on caused by competition than there is in America, where where people go, what the hell, you know, we've got all the, we don't have to compete so hard.
Okay, Forrest, did you have a question?
I didn't have a question.
This is the point.
I was just raising my hand.
I think that we have
when Hunter asked
the same thing here in Canada. No competition with the incumbents, actually. Huh. And I don't think that we're in a policy where we're going to be able to move forward concerning net neutrality. There's going to be some incumbents who will to manage their network. So in order to protect their assets and their ROI, and they don't have any incentive to innovate in the actual model. This is what we see up here.
This is a thing that there's a book just come out to Tim Wu, The Master Switch, which has been out 2 weeks now, where he argues exactly this point, that once you get to a certain size and everything, we don't want to innovate.
It's the same in anything.
Right.
It doesn't matter whatever the corporation is, once it gets so large. It's about intellectual property protection and yep. status quo and
building walls.
Yeah, building walls and protecting the vested interests of the organization and the shareholders of the organization, and that means to slow things down, keep things the way they are, keep them the same because you don't want them to change. Innovation's tricky at that level because you get incumbency.
Right.
You get to that point where you're in and you don't want to get voted out. So you'll say and do whatever you need to stay in power. And corporations can do that in a lot of ways. They buy things that are more innovative and more competitive, threatening to them, and then they kill them. And we've seen that happen in the past 10 years in technology many, many, many times over. I know a lot of hardware vendors, big names, that bought upstarts that had better technology to kill it because it was very highly disruptive to their product line, which has now been embedded into everybody's network, and they have revs that come out, software upgrades that come out, and hey, the last thing in the world they want is the last thing they want is a torpedo coming in. It's like, well, this guy's got a better dense wave box, or this guy's got a better 10 gig, 100 gig box, and it's 10% the cost, and they can manufacture them in China and ship them around the world. And what's the response to the large corporation? They just buy them, and they hire all the people, lock them up in contracts, non-competes, and they don't care if they pay them a couple million bucks to go sit on the beach, and the rest of the world now has to suffer with higher embedded costs, and the network then costs more to run, etc. It's really no different. That's the challenge that we face, all of us.
Question. Are you then suggesting that we buy into the bigger companies?
And then became tough
no.
business model.
No, it's not that you can't. It's not that you can't do something about it. But I'll make one point.
I'll say that what Wu says is that perhaps there should be term limits for monopolies.
Yeah, right. Like again, incumbency in Congress or Senate, where term limits, and they'll never vote for term limits because it's like cutting off their own heads, right? So corporations, like, well, you can only be a monopoly for so many years, and then you have to give it up. Just ask J.P. Morgan if he thought that was a good idea, and see what Teddy Roosevelt did, in response. But back to what Bruce was talking about, and this is very important. At the end user level, okay, the key to the future is mobility. And no one has any appreciation for what goes into everything that makes this device, what makes it actually physically, and what makes it actually work. I was talking to my friend who's in Ukraine, and he's got Vonage, and he's got a 646 number, and I call him up, and we talk all the time, and it doesn't cost anything per minute. He's got an IP phone and all this stuff, and I'm like, man, we came up in the international wholesale business together, and I said, remember what it used to cost a terminated call to Ukraine, or for Ukraine to call the U.S.? It was all refile. It was like $1.50 a minute. I said, now we talk to each other, and it's just an IP connection. Do you know I could sit and think through my head how that call actually was originated on my mobile phone, which tower it went to, how it routed, how it got to 60 Hudson Street, then went to the landing station, which one, subsea transatlantic to London, how that then was routed to Germany, and how that ultimately got into the Ukraine to Ukraine, that got to his house, to his IP connection. I could see it all. And I tried to calculate in my head how much all that cost to build. It's enormous. And I said, could any one individual build the entire network and the device, both ends, just so that we could have that conversation? Absolutely not. So when you get to the end user level and you talk about spectrum right there, that's the ultimate right-of-way agreement. Mm-hmm. Spectrum is licensed from the government. So what do? You help build transport infrastructure that supports the spectrum, which is the end user access device. So now people are talking about how mobile devices are going to be integrated into the enterprise. And it's a big topic, right? So why is it a big topic? Because the enterprise is traditionally fixed. It's fixed line. And that's where we are talking about building fiber infrastructure on a state basis for businesses and office parks and data centers.
That's a different layer of fiber and transport infrastructure that can be managed by businesses that aren't the incumbent. When you get into actually delivering service to a handset, the enormous cost that goes into that, which is being really built now on the backs of fiber to the home, which then the federal tells.
We did a survey of wireless customers, and the average customer only uses 30% of their plan, and about 50% of the people are paying between $1 and $5 a minute for wireless service.
I'm talking about infrastructure basis.
No, right? That's how they're getting the money. They're getting the money from old ladies who pay $20
too much.
And they make too much.
But my point is that we're stuck with having something less than, in this country, 10 probably mobile operators, and maybe less than 5 who are nationwide coverage guys with roaming agreements that are that big, because of the size, and you have to get the spectrum, and it costs billions of dollars just to get the spectrum. So who's going to actually do that part? You know, yeah, there's a lot of rural wireless carriers. I know a lot of them. I have a good friend that has one. And they could do it, but they'll never be national.
Nope.
And they could go build their own towers. They could do it soup to nuts. Antennas, towers, backhaul to a local little pop. Yeah, and it costs a lot of money to run that. And then they're going to be competing with the national brands who can sell a better, broader product, 4G, cost less. And they're going to get edged out. But that's end user, like almost retail. And what I was referring to from a core infrastructure transport basis is a little bit different. And that's where I think that corporations, independent corporations, can really make a difference.
No, I think if you guys aren't out there, we're really screwed. I
mean, Louis made the point before that nobody can do it all. I've said that. Nope. Joe said that. We each do different things. And I think that having an intelligent conversation, you need to be able to break it up into not only the layers of the stack, but what sort of geography you're talking about and who your customer is, what's your addressable market. I could never sell to an end user. I mean, that's totally preposterous, nor could Joe, really.
But that's what makes it so interesting, is when all the mom and pops work together.
Yep. Well,
good things can happen.
They overlap their own regions.
And they do. There are organizations there's organizations that try to do that on a state level basis, like Inditel, which is an association that ION's part of. And Max Huffman of Missouri Network Alliance runs Inditel. He's a great guy, he's a smart guy. And actually the Missouri Network Alliance, I believe, is a conglomeration of 30 different independent telephone companies in Missouri, just in the state of Missouri. And they connect all them as the way ION connects a bunch of different RLEX in New York State.
Speaking strictly an IP base.
Yeah, well, when you start getting to the
data.
When you start getting, well, you have to deal with physical access first and foremost.
Right.
Then you distributed layer 2. Then you can get a distributed peering. And I have long said the Intercarrier Compensation Forum should agree to the Edge Network, should agree to one gigantic enum registry, and then sit at the table with the RBOC and say, now I've got my own 100 and whatever it is million numbers from a voice peering cloud that they could sit with the RBOC and say, I'm as big as you. Yeah, I might be fragmented all over the whole country, but it doesn't matter. This is my block. Now let's peer. Instead of having to pay all these crazy termination origination rates and handoffs and these COs with places that, you know, in Iowa it goes back and it's still 7 cents a minute to terminate a call.
Speaking to a phone company, I'm still
with data.
Yeah, but that is data. That's what I'm talking about. On a distributed IP basis, how do you get disparate islands of networks to actually work together? They must have common layer 2 interconnection points to run distributed layer 3 to right. look like one single network. Right. Well, that requires physical access. The public internet is not going to do it, because in order to do that, you'd need to ride over some other transit network, and you'd be paying $90 a meg, if you're lucky. And then you don't have anything. Then you got a bunch of toll booths. So distributed layer 2 starts with layer 2, which is really one, and common interconnection points.
So do you foresee these groups congealing a little better and grouping and getting larger and taking over a percentage of the business as a series of groups? Or do you think it's basically just going to still be disparate groups that are basically out there and really talking? Again, in other words, will we reach the point where you guys can say we're as large as you guys?
Yes.
Yes. In the future?
They're there. Look, ION's there. Inditel's there. We're talking, Allied Fiber, are speaking with Inditel, which is one association of several, that...
So the ION picture that effectively shows 2,000 route miles across New York State, there are 24 operational live statewide networks. And if we can leverage Hunter's company and Allied and bring these regional networks all together, then effectively you have the power of volume,
unite,
and ability to...
Unite the clans.
Right.
ION's a clan. Unite the clans. Bring them all together. And how? On a layer one infrastructure where they set up their own layer two DWDM and Ethernet switches and create their own peered mesh, and then they can all openly peer at layer three with each other for any application that they want. And can it happen? Yes. Should it happen? Yes. Will it happen? Yeah, if we keep going in the same direction. Inditel's there. Missouri Network Alliance is there. Great Lakes ComNet's there in Michigan. They're in these states. U.S. Carrier is there. They're down in Georgia. They exist. They've already united the independents at the local level, and now they need to be united on the national level. And Joe made the comment before, which, for our Allied Fiber's experience with the broadband stimulus plan, both rounds, there was a complete lack of understanding that this is a national need, because it was relegated to the states, who relegated to their tech czars, who relegated only to recommending projects in their states, because they wanted to take federal dollars and create jobs in their own state, and they didn't care at all about the needs of the United States of America, which is actually on the backs of which the papers being printed that finance these islands that are being built. So there needs to be a bridge to connect the islands. Just as ION is a bridge within New York State to connect islands within New York State, we will too be a bridge to connect ION to other ions. And that makes sense. That's exactly what other countries have done that are smaller. I was in Germany a few weeks ago as the MC of CNX4, which is hosted by Anketel and the DKIX. The DKIX is the largest peering exchange in Frankfurt, probably largest in Europe and in the world, over a terabit sustained of traffic. It's impressive. And Anketel runs the carrier-neutral interconnection facility at Clara 90, which is the carrier hotel in Frankfurt, the gateway between East and West Europe. And I met a company that I'd actually known their name before. I never approached them. I don't know why. WinGas. It's a fiber network, which is a subsidiary of the gas company that's in Germany, and the gas pipeline right away, that they built duct and fiber infrastructure in 1993, because the gas company needed fiber to control the main valves and all the different tributary valves. And then they overbuilt the fiber and have leased dark fiber and colo, neutral colo in colo facilities throughout Germany, which as a country is probably, a couple times the size of Wisconsin, okay? Nowhere near the whole size of the United States, but that's the Allied Fiber model. I discovered it after the fact of coming up with it sort of like in reverse, and it's been operating in Germany successfully, profitably, since 1993. And I asked the guy, who do you sell to? He says, we have about 50 customers. They're all carriers. We sell to Telia and KPN and Deutsche Telekom, even in their own country, and a whole bunch of other folks, because they'd rather lease than build, and who could get the right of way but the gas company, who already has it, et cetera, and it works. And they're just like matter of fact talking about it. Like, well, of course. And I said, what would all of your customers do if you didn't exist? Could they get dark fiber and neutral colo from Deutsche Telekom? She said, oh, no, of course not. I said, and what would happen to you if you were sold to a carrier?
To Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah, to Deutsche Telekom. What would happen to all your tenants? He goes, oh, no. They wouldn't sell them dark fiber. I said, do you realize how important you are to the country of Germany to connect Bonn and Cologne and Stuttgart and Frankfurt and Munich and Berlin? Do you realize how important that is for fiber to the tower and fiber for data centers? It's like, doesn't dawn on him how critically important it is because they've been doing it for so long. He just started working there a couple years ago. Great guy. Didn't understand the critical importance, national importance of that infrastructure. And it's exactly the same story as what I see playing out in other countries all over the world. In Africa, they're building exactly the same thing. In Asia, they're building exactly the same thing. And this is what we need to implement here, the same way. You want to comment on that? So, David?
No. Well, it's 9 o'clock, David.
Are we time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Any other comments?
I've got more questions.
Yeah, okay, well, I don't think we're going to get chased out of here, so if we'd like to take a few more, I have to catch a train at 10 o'clock, or leave at 10 o'clock, break down. But we can take certainly a few more minutes. If
I know that, when Lou was investigating, community broadband here in the city, it was one of the things, we can't, so we could get a connection, and we could get up to, like, the meetup room, and then we could access and so on. But then we started coming up with, one of the blocks we came up against was Kalia. And how do we...
Kalia. Oh, yeah, intercept, lawful intercept.
They're coming down an even more complicated one. How do small communities deal with this? It's a whole other level of expense and complicated.
Yeah, Kalia compliance is an issue. I don't have to deal with that. Maybe you could
speak
to it.
As far as some of our smaller last mile service providers, there are in fact a few third-party service providers that allow that. So you would buy particular probes that you would put on your equipment, and you could hire a third party. So when law enforcement came with that, subpoena and what have you, this third party can pull the information for them to suffice. Our sister company, INOC, who effectively is the ISP for all the rural telephone companies, deemed important enough that we actually brought the talent in-house and do that. When the company was first started, it was more of a strategic decision than cost effectiveness. Initially, it's rather expensive to have it out of the get-go. But if you are interested offline, I'm happy to get you. I know there was two companies that we third-party offer that as a service.
Actually, one quick comment on that with Kalia. When you build a common physical infrastructure that everyone can use and they can get access to, and then whether that's a statewide or a national infrastructure, you can implement a spec, a standard, essentially, and then you can reach economies of scale, basically what Joe just said, economies of scale at that level as well, so that the other sort of tributary networks that connect are just plug and play at multiple layers of the stack, including compliance with lawful intercept. So actually what we're doing helps in that sense, because it creates a standard where there isn't one. And it's not just, like you said, words on a piece of paper. It's a physical layer infrastructure. It has a set of rules about how you come in and how you connect and how it works. How's the door open?
It's pie in the sky. Someone's got to get there before you can, bootstrap.
You can actually start to create it, and that is the way, and that's how it should be implemented, and that's, standards bodies are one thing, but actually...
And it comes back to the book, the thing that we ended up on last time. Really.
Right. Yeah, the book. How do you do it? Matter of fact... there's a project, not necessarily clear related, it's the same sort of thing. You need a physical way. So I've been working with Georgia Tech for a while. Ron Hutchinson, CTO, is a friend of mine. And they're launching their new data center right there in Midtown Atlanta. They're gonna build a whole new building. Two floors of data center and then a high rise with office and all kinds of stuff. And it's amazing, it's gonna be half containers, half pods, and half raised floor. And it's a how-to for every other school, which is the beautiful thing about it. Because he had the challenge of where do I put all my cores and how do I grow for the School of Medicine and Engineering and Aeronautics and all this other stuff. Well, he had to create a physical layer plan at the real estate level from the manhole in the street to the building, to the everything. And you know, you can grow it and shape it and size it, but then as you enter, it's an environment now. It's a compute environment. So if you think about HPC and you think about what they're going to be able to create and output, and they can host things, but they can run cycles for other people or themselves, you know, Kalia is just another one of the little tick boxes, for example, in a carrier environment where you can move into the physical infrastructure and have everything basically there so that you don't need to reinvent the wheel yourself. That's amazing. So what Ron and Georgia Tech are going to basically do is not only publish the book, it's the blueprints of how to do it. They're going to actually do it. And then all the other schools that are saying, well, we don't know how to build a high performance computing data center, they'll say, well, here's my book. And oh, by the way, if you don't want to build your own, we can host all your apps in ours. You can do one or the other. And that is genius and amazing. And that's what we need. Because Joe's not Georgia Tech, neither am I. And all the schools are out there, and they all need to grow because they've got no more space. They have no more space, no more power, no more cooling, no more room. But they've got growing needs from every single group.
They're all falling into the lap of the cloud. And for instance, NYU just passed all their email over to Gmail, announced this week.
Oh, did they?
Really?
That's really cloud.
That's really good.
That's Uber cloud. That's like scary cloud. I mean, I don't know why I do that. But I like those guys. But, you know, hosted email is one thing. Again, physical infrastructure, power, cooling, this is real money, you know, this is heavy duty stuff. And we see, everybody sees a lot of corporations going now towards Microsoft and what they did with their site in Chicago and their hosting Office and Windows and whatever apps. And now companies that heretofore had to buy servers to run that stuff, they don't need data centers, they don't need servers, they don't need to buy, they could just buy it and it's hosted on Microsoft. And Microsoft deals with all the security and all the upgrades and all the bugs and everything else, and you don't have to have techs and you don't have to deal with all that. That's real cloud. That's, you know, heavy duty stuff. And maybe in the same sense NYU gives their email to Gmail. Those are all servers that they don't need to house, that they don't need to run. They're going to be in a Google data center somewhere. It's not a trend. I mean, that's a reality that exists today and it's going to continue to go. And Kalia and other things obviously are embedded sort of behind that. So in a sense, if your provider is compliant and you've outsourced it to them, you're compliant in that instance.
But if you want to be your own provider, then it's a problem.
At layer one and two, if you follow the ION model, Joe's got something that he could sell you to say, turnkey, you're compliant. Every ION in every state should have the same exact thing, and it should be as simple as the OSI model.
ION is not in New York City, though, right?
Telex space.
Yeah, 60 Hudson, ninth floor. Oh. You cross connect, you're in. Check the box.
Because we certainly have plenty of smaller ISPs, you know, who at the end of the day want to be, you know, billing the end user, doing the desktop support. That all areas that we, you know, don't deal with. But our sister company INOC, we have the fiber coming in from New York City and Buffalo into the Albany data center. And in the data center, I'll call it white label ISP, you know, whether it's authentication or caching or, you know, spam control. Why have all these smaller ISPs or rural telephone companies with DSLAMs and selling DSL, why should all of they be figuring out Kalia? Why should they be figuring out caching? Why should they be figuring out, you know, these things? And on top of it, you know, bringing the 12 telephone companies together, now we got, you know, 40,000 broadband subscribers. And when you need, you know, bigger boxes, bigger bandwidth, volume discounts, you know, it's a good thing. So, you know, that's kind of our, you know, experience, you know, on that end. And you know, we take off a little bit in terms of some of the things that, you know, Hunter talking about, some of the products that we're, you know, looking at and working is, a lot of your tax money here in New York State got put into what's called Luther Forest, up near Saratoga Springs, a chip fab plant. The state put $1 billion into a chip fab plant, and Abu Dhabi put in another $3 billion, chip fab 8. Construction had already started. They're looking to hire 2,000 people, and guess what? No one's stepped up to lay the fiber across this campus. But they need 10GE service to connect the chip fab plant in Saratoga Springs to the computer at RPI, Rensselaer Polytech, IBM Fishkill, And but it blows my mind that we're bringing in water from the huge lake, because the chip fab needs oodles of water from, you know, from the clean room perspective. So that, the electric, National Grid, was brought in, saw a whole substation, and we're having conversations with them now after the building is up, and they're Tokyo Electron's bringing equipment in that, you know, someone needs to build fiber. And oh, by the way, we need 10 GE to a large computer.
$90 a meg, we can do it.
Everyone, how many examples have you heard of that? Everybody forgets about the fiber till the end. They're just like, oh, what, the building, we built it out. $4 billion is the biggest number I've heard to date for that kind of faux pas. Yep. And then they go, oh yeah, just call the carrier and get the fiber and turn it up. Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, you're exactly 72 miles away from nothing, and you've got POTS. Good luck. There goes your data center.
Just a quick comment that in the stimulus rules in round two, they had to put in a rule that the networks had to connect to the internet, because several applications in round one did not actually connect to the internet.
No. That's great.
Unbelievable. Okay, Louis, do you have any last remarks that you want to make?
Well, a few minutes ago, you were talking about third-party companies, you know, providing last mile of services and or athletes of broadband. And one thing that we've been discovering, that sometimes third-party company was owned by a first-party company. Which
is so that's not good.
It's another way to make money with no investment at all. Okay. But the third party was just selling the service a little bit more expensive than what we should have had from the incumbent. Anyway, it was just a remark. I really appreciated being with you tonight, guys. I missed a few questions. I didn't see you, but you know, the microphone was not always at good place at a good time, but it's not that bad. You know, I really appreciated what I've heard, and I think that we have to find some ways to keep working together, and I would certainly like to talk to Hunter and Joe again, and all you guys, maybe separately, but or using email. And then continue to see what we could be doing together, definitely.
Well, that's fantastic. We definitely want to make that happen. Okay, so I'd like to thank everybody for coming, and especially for Joe and Louis through Skype, and for Hunter, and everybody's input here. And we definitely want to, continue this conversation and build relationships, obviously. And if there are ways that, you can work together, Hunter, with Louis. We want to make that happen. Something that Jolly had suggested a while ago when we first started talking was the idea of ISOC New York putting together a manual, that, like we were talking about, sort of a how-to manual, how to be Allied Fiber or ION, how to do that. That would be helpful to other network providers and things like that.
You just need an army of interns.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, I'm sure you got one right here. Right here. A lot more than I have.
Well, we can find a way to do that, though.
All right, great.
And we need to buy more microphones so that we can do this.
And thank you guys for putting this together.
Yeah,
this is very beneficial.
I just wanted to say that we have a toolkit that we've been producing in the Connect project to have some local authorities or a local booth to run from A to Z. And the book that you were talking about would be really appreciated, if you could start. I'll translate it.
That's great. Okay, so we could put together a wiki where everybody could participate and get some people to work on editing and compiling the material and put that together. We've got that in place, actually. Okay, thanks again. I'm going to sign up.
Thank you.
And we'll go from there.
Merci.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome.
All right, Joe, that was great, pleasure, man. Always, always.
It's interesting. I love your analogy. See each other here.